Well, good afternoon and welcome along. It's Saturday afternoon, it's 2:30. That means Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Justin Brierley. Your regular dose of apologetics discussion and debate between Christians and non-Christians. And I've got quite the mind-bending, brain-frazzling scientific issue today for you as we're going to hear about the multiverse. Is there more than one universe? Well, we'll hear from two people who say actually they think there is. I'll be introducing them in a moment's time. If you want more discussions and debates across all kinds of areas, but broadly looking at whether Christianity makes sense, is coherent, is philosophically defensible, all of that kind of stuff, go to the Unbelievable webpage, subscribe to our podcast, check out some of the other resources we've got there, including this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and CD, and of course available as a digital download. All available at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. If you're listening after Unbelievable this afternoon, you can hear The Profile between 4 and 5. Nigel Ippinson Fleming is a musician who's worked with artists as diverse as OMD and the Stone Roses. He's an accomplished pianist and a music producer, but he's also a church pastor, and he's going to be telling us his story. That's after Unbelievable at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. Loads that I've been saving up over several weeks this summer. So we'll be hearing a lot of that later on today. Right now, time to get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking who's afraid of the multiverse? My guests are Phil Harper and Jeff Zwierink. In recent years, the word multiverse has been on the lips not just of physicists, but those involved in Christian apologetics too. The multiverse theory that there are many, perhaps a potentially infinite number of universes, is often seen as a controversial one, and many Christians actually regard it as an attempt on the part of non-believers to escape the force of the argument for design from the fine-tuning of the universe. So if there are many universes, then we just happen to be in the one where the fundamental constants and quantities do permit the development of life. And many, and I would count myself among them, have responded that, well, there's no evidence for this multiverse that you've postulated. But today, both my Christian and atheist guests are persuaded, actually, that the multiverse theory has a lot going for it. It's probably true and predicted by our best theories about the universe's origins. So our atheist guest on the programme today is Phil Harper. He's been on the show a couple of times in the past. He's known online as Skydive Phil, and he's behind a few self-produced YouTube documentaries tackling what he believes are often common misconceptions in Christian apologetics about science. And his latest film is titled Before the Big Bang 4, Eternal Inflation and the Multiverse. So if you want to check out his channel on YouTube, it's Skydive Phil. Astrophysicist Jeff Zwierink also returns to the programme. He's a research scholar with Reason to Believe, a Christian organisation putting science and the Bible together. Jeff authored Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? It's a book that's available online and which examines the multiverse theory and its implications for Christianity. If you want more about Reasons to Believe, reasons.org is the place to go. And today we're going to be asking things like, well, what is the evidence for a multiverse? Does it explain away the mystery of fine-tuning? Is it a problem believing in a multiverse for God and for Christianity? So I'm really looking forward to today's programme because I think I'm going to learn a lot, as I often do when two guests who know a lot more about subjects than me come on to discuss these things. And I think it'll be interesting because I think there'll be a lot of shared ground, actually, between my Christian and atheist guest on the programme today. But I'm sure we'll get to some disagreement as well in the process. So first of all, welcome, Phil, to the programme today. How are you doing, Phil? Welcome
back. Thanks, Justin. It's great to be on the show again. It's a real honour to be on it three times now.
Hey, you're welcome back because you're an atheist, but who's of the very cordial variety, if I can put it that way.
And if only you knew me.
I'm always stunned though whenever I hear about what you seem to be the most jet-setting, thrill-seeking person I've ever met. I asked you, what you've been doing recently? Oh, just diving with beluga whales in northern Canada. you've obviously got a lust for life,
yes.
And that extends itself to wanting to understand what this universe is and how it's
It's funny, on the trip I was speaking to people and we were talking about many of these issues and we thought there's a commonality, you know, people that want to experience the world also want to understand it.
You came along to my Unbelievable conference back in July. which I applaud you for, because it is essentially a conference aimed at Christians, yes. Let me be honest, even though the show itself always brings right. Christians and atheists together. But you went as an atheist and were very kind about some of the stuff that went on there and were interested, I think, to view it from that perspective. And I think you've sort of made friends with some of the
we had a great dinner afterwards, actually.
Yeah, in the Christian apologetics world, which I think is fantastic. There was, of course, that was when I sort of showed a little video I'd worked on the issue of fine-tuning and so on. Which you have been desperate ever since to respond to. So we'll try and make time for that on today's programme, because it does very much tie into our theme today. But welcome back.
It's Thank great you very to much. Have you back. Thank you. And hi, Jeff.
And yes, Jeff, welcome to the programme today yourself. Jeff, you will remember, of course, that the last time you were on, I think, was in a conversation with Phil here. What have you been up to recently in the year and a half, I think, since we last had you on?
Oh, I've been doing just a fair bit of raising my family, trying to just kind of see what sort of science is out there. I'm in the process of writing a book on just asking the question, is there life out in the universe? What evidence do we have? Might we actually find it? And if we did, how would that impact with the Christian faith? And so just trying to develop resources, really, and one of the things I see myself doing is helping Christians see that we don't have to be scared of science. That if God is who he says he is, that what we find scientifically will accord with what he's revealed in Scripture.
Well, it'd be interesting to see, perhaps later on in the show, how that ties into the idea of a multiverse theory. But I was able to visit you just over the summer at your very own offices there in California, Jeff, and it was great to meet the wider team right. from Reasons to Believe. What a lovely bunch of people, and what a beautiful set of offices as well.
Thanks.
It's lovely to spend time, but we had a little chat, obviously, about this upcoming show. And you bent my mind in terms of it was hard to get around some of the concepts from a layperson's point of view. So I am going to put out that little thing that I often do at the beginning of any show where we're talking about difficult subjects like multiverse theory. We'll try and include as many people as we can in the conversation. So if I have to ask questions right. like, oh, please explain that in a more simplistic way, I hope you'll forgive me, gentlemen. But thanks both for coming back on the programme today. Let's talk about, firstly, your book, Jeff. I should say before we get into that, if you want to respond to anything you hear on the programme today, more than welcome to send in your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can, of course, find ways to respond as well online via social media from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to our Facebook and Twitter accounts, and, of course, today's show, which you can download, send on to friends, comment underneath, and more.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So yes, let's come to you, Jeff, as we open this topic. Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? That, of course, is the name of the booklet you wrote on this whole topic. Just tell us then briefly, you yourself have actually had a change of mind over several years on the issue of the multiverse, haven't you?
I really have. And in some sense, the book was born out of a conversation that I had close to 15 years ago now, where I was discussing with a group of scientists whether you could scientifically have theological explanations involved. And we were talking about whether the universe had a beginning, whether the universe had design. And one of the responses that came up was one of the fellows that challenged me. He goes, yeah, but in what universe are you talking about? And this was just right when the multiverse was kind of becoming scientifically popular. And I didn't have a good answer for it. And so I've spent a number of years just trying to understand, figure out what it says. And while I initially thought, oh, the multiverse, that's just a way people are using to get around some arguments for God, I realized there's some really good scientific reasons why a multiverse might exist. And I'm actually convinced that one probably does at this point.
So if you would briefly, and I know it's hard to do that with such a huge issue, could you give us sort of a sense of the reasons you lay out in that book why, scientifically speaking, a multiverse hypothesis is a good one?
I would say probably the biggest scientific reason why is that we've got this epoch of inflation that occurred in our universe. Or rather, without this epoch of inflation, it's very difficult to explain the properties of our universe. And when you look at the way inflation operates, the very fact that inflation occurred says that the universe is far larger than what we can see. And if our mechanism for explaining inflation is correct, and I'm inclined to think it is, then a very natural implication of that is that there are other universes as well.
Now, just explain inflation for us. What do you mean by inflation?
So inflation is this, we tend to, or we're very comfortable thinking of things linearly. That if I drive, here in the United States, 55 miles an hour, every hour I go 55 miles, and if I wait longer, I just keep adding on that at that same rate. In the early universe, the universe grew in a very different way, in that every period of time, it actually doubled in size. And so it just grew very, very rapidly, very, very quickly, and got very, very large. And that helps explain a lot of the large-scale features we see in our universe.
So it was sort of exponential growth almost in that
right,
sense.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And so this period of inflation, do you know sort of how long that went on for?
It's fractions of a second, 10 to the minus 34 seconds, something like that. It's a very small period of time. But again, because of this exponential growth, the universe that we can see grew from something the size of the basketball to the size of our observable universe now. So it got very large very quickly.
Sure. So again, you'll have to keep this simple, but precisely what is it about that period of expansion that would give rise to the idea that there are, in fact, many universes?
Two aspects. One is that just the fact that this very rapid expansion occurred means that there's stuff beyond what we can see. There's a limit to how far we can see just simply because the universe is only 14 billion years old and the speed of light is large but a finite value. So there's a distance, a maximum distance we can see, and inflation just says there's more stuff beyond that. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is that the mechanism for producing inflation, as we look at the scientifically how we could explain why inflation occurred, that mechanism that produces inflation doesn't just produce one universe, it produces multiple universes.
Again, this would be like a big question then, wouldn't it, to ask you to explain that. I mean, is there any kind of simple analogy or way of... perhaps we'll come to Phil for that, because we should share this hard work out between you both to talk about this. Let me cross to you then, Phil. You've produced a YouTube film on this. I'm sure if people want the full-blooded explanation, they can go there.
Yes, we do interview Alan Guth, who's the inventor of inflationary theory, plus a number of other famous cosmologists to discuss it.
Yeah, and you were quite impressed with Phil's film, I understand, Jeff. Is that fair?
I did. I thought it was a very well-produced film. It explained a lot of the essential elements very well. So
for a layperson like me, you've approached this as a layperson yourself, but obviously with a bit more time to look into it, Phil, where would you go? How would you try and explain why this inflation produces many universes, not just our universe?
Sure, okay. So the simplest explanation I can think of, I'll give a slight technical one and then the analogy. Okay, so the first slightly technical bit would be that you have this inflating space. It's growing exponentially, but this inflating space is unstable. So it decays. And obviously it must do because the universe isn't growing at that speed now. So it decays. And the interesting thing is when it decays, it actually creates a hot soup of matter and radiation, which we can actually think of as the Big Bang. Okay. So in fact, Alan Guth has described inflation as a prequel to the hot Big Bang. So inflation decays and it creates a Big Bang.
And it produces lots of sort of spots.
Yeah, well, what happens is if you think about what's happening to the bit of the inflating space that hasn't decayed, because it decays with a half-life. Mm. So half of it hasn't decayed yet. So what's happening to that bit? Well, it's growing at this unbelievably, incredibly exponential rate. So the amount of inflating space never goes down. So it doesn't just create one Big Bang. It creates one after another and after another. So the analogy I'll give is imagine you go to my parents' house. Mm. My mum makes this divine chocolate cake. And she puts the cake down on the table. Half the cake goes almost straight away. It's really yummy cake. Okay, then a little bit later, we go back for seconds, and then the whole cake's gone. Mm. But imagine if this cake was undergoing exponential expansion. Mm. Then when we went back for seconds, it would be enormously bigger than what you started with.
Right.
So how many pieces of cake could you have?
Mm.
And endless pieces of cake, right?
Right.
So how many Big Bangs does inflation create? An endless number.
A potentially endless number. I mean, okay, does that sort of work for you, Jeff, just to cross-check that with as a way of thinking about it?
Yeah, no, I think that's... Yeah, there's lots of questions of when in the sequence and that sort of stuff, but I think the basic point that it creates a lot of them is that's just a natural implication of how we understand inflation working.
I understand there's a number of other sort of aspects of our universe as well that those who propose multiverse theory from inflation believe that it sort of solves effectively. Yeah. Do you want to lead us into that?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's four difficult problems of standard Big Bang cosmology that inflation is thought to solve. And it was invented really just to solve one of them. So the first one was called the monopole problem. And what happened was that theorists back in the 1970s when this was proposed thought that the early universe at these very high temperatures would produce a lot of these particles called monopoles. And the universe would be swimming in them. But yet, we don't see them today.
Mm.
Well, why not? And not only that, but we couldn't see them today because they'd be too heavy to actually stop the universe from expanding.
Okay.
So the question was, what can you do to physics to stop this monopole problem? And what happened was two physicists, Alan Guth and Henry Tai, worked on this, and they came up with this idea that it would be a sort of phase transition. That if you think about how water cools, you know, it can go from liquid water to ice, and these are phase transitions.
Mm.
And there's a particular type of phase transition called supercooling. And they suggested that this would fix this monopole problem. Then Henry Tai went away on holiday, and he said, Alan, can you just check, does this have any implications for the expansion rate of the early universe? So he did some calculations, and he was in for a shock, because it created this exponential expansion, this unbelievably rapid rate of expansion. And then he noticed that it solves another problem called the flatness problem, which is actually a problem that you mentioned in your DICE film, which people should watch. It's great. but the point is this fine-tuning problem, which is why is the base... You can think of it in different ways. One, the expansion rate of the early universe, and then why is the universe so geometrically flat?
Mm.
These are two opposite sides of the
right.
same coin.
Mm.
So it actually... That problem, it looks like it's incredibly improbable that you would have this flat universe. But those probabilities, those calculations are done assuming gravity is always attractive. But this exponential expansion implies a negative gravitational field. And that turns the equations upside down. So now, instead of being incredibly improbable, it's actually incredibly probable. And there's two other mysteries. One's called the horizon problem, which is if you look, you know, billions of light years in one direction, billions of light years in the other direction, it looks to be too similar to what you could allow for given, you know, how much time there's been since the Big Bang. So these two bits of the sky could not be in causal contact. But inflation solves that by creating this rapid expansion of something that was initially in causal contact. But then you might say, well, okay, well, maybe it was just, you know, homogeneous already. But then you have the problem of, well, then how do you get structures in the universe? Where do the galaxies come from? And what inflation does, this was discovered at a conference in Nuffield in 1982, I think, that Stephen Hawking organized. And they calculated that this inflation would blow up quantum fluctuations. It would stretch them and create these sort of inhomogeneities, which actually seed the formation of galaxies. So, in fact, our leading theory of galaxy formation is inflation.
Right. Okay. So, and these are the kinds of evidences that have for you made you think that actually, yes, inflation and its corollary multiverse would explain these aspects of the universe that we do see around us, Jeff?
Well, I would say yes. That's, I mean, inflation in, you could say roughly, inflation was invented to solve these problems. And the fact that it does solve these problems makes it a serious scientific contender for an explanation of how the universe operates. And then there's the additional question of, do we have scientific evidence, or do we have other evidence that inflation is correct? And I think there is, but the fact that it solved all these important problems really, I think, got people's attention and said, hey, this is something we need to seriously consider.
Now, the thing is that, again, I'll say it again, you guys have thought through this. You've been able to sit down and read the books and see the videos and so on. Many people, this will be the first time they're hearing about this and the theories and so on. So if there are these other universes that were spawned in the earliest moments of our universe and this inflationary period, I mean, what are they? Do they kind of exist kind of independently of our universe? Are they sort of, could we ever observe them in any way? Or are they in that sense purely a a hypothetical working out of what we do see in that sense.
So I would say that you can't directly observe the other universes. They're separated by space that's expanding very, very rapidly. And this inflation is going on now, but just not in our part of the universe. However, there are ways you could maybe detect the presence of the other universes. So there's obviously the indirect way of just testing inflation more and more and more. And there are predictions that inflation made for the for statistical properties of the cosmic microwave background. And NASA's WMAP probe and the European Space Agency's Planck probe have made maps of the cosmic microwave background, and they report back that those statistical properties are found. So if you go on NASA's WMAP website, it says, we have detected a key signature of inflation. And furthermore, we interviewed in our film Georges Eustathio. He's the person that gave the press conference results for the Planck probe. And we asked him, does your data tell us, is this eternal inflation, this is the inflation that produces the multiverse, favoured by the data? And he said, yes, it is strongly favoured by the data. So we asked him, so does that mean you've got evidence for a multiverse? Mm-hmm. And he says, yes, we have. Now, of course, it's indirect. There are more direct ways to probe. So there's a possibility that maybe these other bubbles might have collided in our early universe. Mm. But we have to be very, very lucky to see that. And so far, we haven't seen that.
I've read somewhere, I'm sure, an article which suggested that a patch of sort of some kind of cosmic background radiation that looks different into the rest of the night sky could be evidence of a collision early on in the...
It could be. I mean, there are anomalies.
Is that all rather tentative at this point?
Yes, or? I mean, there are anomalies. We do discuss this in the film, but there are anomalies in the cosmic microwave background, something that you wouldn't quite expect. Mm. Now, the question is, you've only got one universe to observe. So is that just an effect of that?
Yeah.
Or is it a real sign? So it could be, and people are working on that, and the hope is that maybe they can predict something for the polarization that we haven't seen, and then we can check it that way.
So, Jeff, you've over the course of time changed your mind on this, come round to the view that it is pretty well supported multiverse theory. Would you say that's generally the direction in astrophysics that people have gone? That actually it's held up as a pretty credible theory these days.
It really has, and as I've been kind of surveying and watching for the last 10, maybe 15 years, it seems that the multiverse has gone from a interesting idea to something that seems to be the dominant idea. You know, I think the discovery of the statistical properties of the cosmic microwave background that Phil was mentioning seems to have put the multiverse idea really as, I would almost argue, maybe the dominant idea in cosmology today.
There are people, I know, who do take a different view, and cosmologists. I think I've come across people like George Ellis who object that it isn't scientifically testable at some level, observable and so on. I mean, on this very show a few years ago, admittedly, Roger Penrose dismissed it as saying he just thought it would kind of... For him, I forget exactly the context, but he was saying essentially he felt it was used too easily as an explanation for things. So this, I mean, I get the sense it's not universally adopted by all people in the field. Is that fair, Jeff?
I think that's true, and I think you're going to find different people object for different reasons. That there's a sense that if you say, well, the multiverse explains all of this stuff, it makes it very difficult to then ask the question, what could happen that would to differentiate whether that was just a very rare event or whether that was something that we could test scientifically. And so there are some philosophical implications to how you use the multiverse to solve problems. But I think a lot of cosmologists are convinced, based on the mechanism of inflation, that we may live in a multiverse.
I mean, other things that are sometimes put forward, and I'm sure you both have heard, but that it can be used just as a sort of a get-out, an ad hoc explanation, if you like, for the fact that we do apparently observe fine-tuning of the universe and so on. What would be your response to that, Phil?
I think it's not ad hoc because you've got independent reasons for thinking the multiverse is there. If you just said, well, maybe there's a multiverse, then that would be ad hoc. But because you've got these independent reasons for thinking there's a multiverse, i.e. inflationary theory, then it's not ad hoc. Now just to pick up on Penrose, because we made a film with Penrose as well. Mm. So it's worth giving some caveats here because it sounds like I'm selling the multiverse, I'm convinced. And actually, I'm actually not convinced there's a multiverse. What I'm convinced of is that the evidence for the multiverse is better than most people think it is.
Okay.
But I'm actually not convinced there is a multiverse. Mm. So it's worth giving some caveats, and this is where we can connect Penrose's comments. Mm. Inflation has passed every single observational test to date, and there have been many. But there's one last observational test still to be done. And there are a few, and I think it's a small minority, but they are notable cosmologists, who think it will fail at this last hurdle. Mm. And they've proposed alternative cosmologies that will try and fix these four problems, because you need to fix these four problems. Mm. And what Penrose has suggested as an alternative to inflation is a cyclic cosmology.
Which is what he was on to talk about on that program.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I would suggest is, and if you look at the alternatives to inflation, and there are alternatives, so CCC, Penrose's model is one, but there are others. Most of them are cyclic cosmologies. You have to have something before the Big Bang, really, to fix these problems if it's not inflation. Mm. So I don't know of any competitors that are not at least have something before the Big Bang. So it seems like you're stuck with some type of world ensemble, whether it's a multiverse with universes separated in space or whether they're universes separated in time, like in a cyclic cosmology. Yeah. I know of, maybe Jeff, you know some, I don't know of any competitors to inflation that don't have at least that feature.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a good point. And you know, what's interesting is I look throughout the history of the last 100 years of cosmology, is that this idea that there might be other universes out there has been around at times, but only with the advent of inflation has it become more than just an interesting speculation that it might actually be the correct explanation. And so, but I would concur with Phil there that at some level, in order to explain what we have, either you have to invoke some sort of incredible fine tuning that the universe is just set up this way and this is the only way it is, or you end up with some sort of ensemble explanation where there's multiple universes, whether they be cyclical in time, whether they be distributed throughout some inflationary space, whether they be some sort of quantum mechanical multiverse, you end up with something like that.
Well, maybe in the next section, and we'll go to a break now, Jeff, you could also explain for us why you don't think it means that the fine-tuning is, as it were, completely to be set aside just because of the multiverse. And I think we should come to that and talk about the implications for God as well, if there are any, of a multiverse theory. And we'll see if we can play a little bit of my dice video as well, which has been mentioned already. So come back again in a short moment's time. We're asking, who's afraid of the multiverse, examining multiverse theory? In fact, with two people who are both pretty convinced it's got a lot going for it today. My atheist guest, Phil Harper, has produced a YouTube video on the whole subject. And astrophysicist Jeff Swearink, research scholar with Reasons to Believe, has written a book on the subject. So come again in just a few moments' time as we continue today's discussion here on the show that aims to get the grey cells going. Unbelievable. Meet the man who can manufacture miracles in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. Famed illusionist Derren Brown's TV and stage shows have wowed audiences across the UK. He was once a Christian and, in our exclusive interview, talks about faith, doubt, and why his latest show targets charismatic healing evangelists. Plus, we've advice on pastors and pedestals, what to do when leaders fall, and, as university season begins, how your church can reach students. All that plus much more. Why not request our September edition absolutely free at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Hope you're enjoying this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley with the show that brings you Christians and non-Christians in dialogue and discussion every single week. Unbelievable, your place for apologetic discussion and debate, theology, scripture, ethics, and much more besides. Today, though, tackling a particular scientific issue, the multiverse. And it's something that often comes up in one form or another in Christian apologetics because of the issue of the fine-tuning of the universe. It's often posited, well, if there is a a multiverse, many universes. Perhaps this is an explanation for why we happen to live in a universe that appears to be so well designed, as it were, for our existence. Well, we're going to get back into this topic in a moment's time with my two guests, atheist guest Phil Harper, who as a layman has really looked into these issues and produced some interesting documentaries on the back of them, and astrophysicist Jeff Swearing from Reasons to Believe. If you'd like to contact me yourself about these subjects, I'd be interested to hear your response to it. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, find us online and get in touch that way. You can leave a comment underneath today's show. Don't forget to tell your friends about Unbelievable, and why not subscribe them to the podcast as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. Don't forget that straight after today's programme, between 4 and 5, you can also hear The Profile, another Christian telling us about their life story, their journey of faith. That's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. So who's afraid of the multiverse, we've been asking today, and really our conversation to some extent on this whole thing started when I presented this video that's done the rounds a little bit recently, my brief attempt to kind of give a sense of what the fine-tuning argument is. I likened it to rolling a dice 70 times in a row, and the odds of getting a 6 every time are about the same odds as, I said, the inflation of the universe being just right to enable life to develop in the future. And there are more than there are some 30 or so fundamental constants and quantities that are often seen as having this fine-tuning sort of aspect to them. So what I'll do is I'll just play a little bit from the end of that video. And again, if you want to go and watch that, you can find it from the YouTube channel for Premier, and I'll make sure there's a link to it in today's programme description. But you certainly had some questions about this video, Phil, so we'll hear what those are. But here's a little bit that specifically mentioned the multiverse and whether that was an adequate response to the apparent fine-tuning of the universe.
The fact that we're here shows that someone's loaded the dice. In fact, maybe there's no dice at all. What if the evidence points to this life-permitting universe actually being the product of an intelligent mind which intended for us to be here? Now, you could come up with some speculative other theory. Maybe there's an infinite number of universes giving you an infinite number of chances to roll the dice. Maybe. But we don't have any scientific evidence for it. So if you're hanging your hat on that possibility, then you're every bit as much committed to a faith position as the person who says God was behind it.
Okay, so there you go. That was just sort of towards the end of that video called How a Dice Can Show That God Exists. Now, I'm ready to hold my hands up, guys, and say if I jumped the gun, as I think probably it would be fair to say lots of other people involved in Christian apologetics, by saying there's no scientific evidence for a multiverse in that video, then I'll hold my hands up and say, my bad. I mean,
well, it isn't just you, Justin. I mean, many people have said there's no evidence for for inflation, even.
Right.
William Lane Craig, in his debate with Peter Millikan that you sponsored, he said there's no evidence for inflation, and he wrote in 1996 that the densities of the universe, there's a number called omega, and it was observed to be too low for inflation to be correct. But a few years later, those numbers were revised and they matched inflation. So if he thought that was evidence against inflation, he should now think it's evidence for it.
I mean, Jeff, what would you say? Do you often hear, you know, in the circles you move in, there's no scientific evidence for the multiverse?
You know, I hear that in quite often among Christian apologists. And I think... that's if you go back and look at the historical articles I've written, I think the first one published on our website, I don't think I made that claim, but I kind of alluded to, oh, the multiverse really isn't something we need to pay that much attention to, that it's just going to wash away scientifically. But I do think that there is strong evidence for inflation. You know, I don't think you can use the homogeneity and the expansion or the horizon problem and the flatness problem and, you know, the things that Phil was describing earlier, because that's what inflation was designed to solve. So that's not particularly evidence for inflation. But as we have gone out and measured the cosmic microwave background radiation and its homogeneity and the fluctuations in it and the statistical properties of those fluctuations, basically everything that inflation predicts about those we've measured, and I think inflation really is the best explanation for that data. So I think there is actually, it's not compelling evidence for a multiverse, but it's strong evidence that the multiverse certainly is within the realm of scientific explanations, and it's here to stay. So
there's one thing I want to disagree with, actually. So here we go. We've got some disagreement. I don't think it's quite true to say that inflation was designed to solve these four problems. Historically speaking, if you read Alan Guth's book and if you watch our film, he says that it was only developed to solve one problem, which was the monopole problem. And then quite quickly afterwards, he realized it solved the flatness problem. And then it wasn't until like 2 or 3 years later that it was realized it solved like the structure problem. So it wasn't designed to solve all four of these problems, really only one of them. And then it was noticed it solved the other ones.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'll stipulate that. I mean, that's fine. That doesn't kind of get around the point that once we figured out what inflation said and then could actually make calculations of what it would predict about the cosmic microwave background, we went out and measured those and found that it is. So, I mean, the evidence that people point to of inflation is not those original four problems. It's that it matches where the peak in the multiple background or the multiple expansion, the multiple peaks. It's these other statistical properties that people point to as the independent evidence for inflation.
Well, granted all that, I mean, what do you do with the issue of fine tuning then yourself, Jeff? Because does for you fine tuning them fly out the window? Well, okay, if there are many universes, you know, there are lots of potential different ways in which those universes could exist, and we happen to live in the one that was capable of producing intelligent life. Does it kind of, you know, finesse out of the air the issue of fine tuning?
I think it impacts how, as Christians, we need to make a fine tuning argument, because most of the way we've talked about that fine tuning, I kind of characterize it as a fundamental and an environmental fine tuning. There's the environmental fine tuning that you've got to find the right type of star and the right type of planet at the right distance, where you could imagine things being different. And if inflation happened, the universe is far larger than we see. And so though even if you acknowledge that the probability of an Earth-like place is small, the universe is just large enough that it would overwhelm those probabilities. And so it becomes an almost certainty. Where the multiverse comes in is in those parameters which couldn't change, the fundamental ones, the strength of the fundamental forces, the speed of light, the expansion rate of the universe. Now in the multiverse says there's lots of different options there. And so I think it becomes reasonable to say, if the multiverse exists, that might explain why we see such a fine-tuned universe, because the only universe in which we could exist is one which appears fine-tuned. So I think it does impact that argument. And I spent the better part of a year kind of saying, well, if this is true, I may just have to say that we don't have a fine-tuning argument right now. And so I think that is something as Christians we need to wrestle with pretty seriously.
You've talked about the fact that at one level, I mean, there could still be, if you like, some responses. As I understand it, obviously people like William Lane Craig and others have said we wouldn't expect to find ourselves in this particular universe if there is a multiverse. It's far more likely that we would be given this term, a Boltzmann brain, a brain that fluctuates into and out of existence, observing itself and so on. Those types of universes are far more likely, because it's kind of so fine-tuned to allow for the type of universe we do live in, that it seems, well, why this particular fine-tuned universe in that sense? Do you have a response to that, Jeff, before I come back to Phil?
No, and I think that's where the multiverse kind of impacts these probability-type arguments. But ultimately, when you're where people thought the laws of physics were fine-tuned, as you said, okay, the laws of physics allow carbon to exist, and it allows certain things to happen that is essential to life, but there were lots of other ways they could be envisioned, and so the particular values seemed odd or unnatural or atypical. And so now if you're going to use the multiverse to say, oh, everything, you know, we're fine-tuned because we're one little pocket of a vastly different universe, you now have to ask the question, is there other ways life could be there? And are we typical life? And that's where you get into the idea of these Boltzmann brain fluctuations and computer simulations by advanced civilizations and other things. You have to ask the question, is it more likely that we're part of one of these other bizarre scenarios, or is it more likely that we have this evolutionary history that scientists have put forth as an explanation? And I think when you ask those sorts of questions, we begin to look atypical again, and that's an evidence for design or purpose.
And the atypicalness of what we see is that we live in a very large universe. I mean, what are the aspects that would seem unlikely if you know, just doing the statistics, we were to observe ourselves in a particular universe?
Well, and that's fair, and it's there's lots of different there's no single way to characterize it. But you say, all right, are we actually real people or are we Boltzmann brains? And it seems more probable, given the way most inflationary scenarios work, that Boltzmann brains are the more likely form of life. So if we're not a Boltzmann brain, then we're atypical. Or if we are a Boltzmann brain, the most common form of Boltzmann brain is one that pops into existence for a very brief period of time and sees a very disordered universe. But yet, if we're a Boltzmann brain, we've existed for a long period of time, or we see a very ordered universe, one of the two, and in that case, we're atypical. Or maybe the multiverse is fashioned so that it doesn't produce Boltzmann brains. But again, that's a particular kind of multiverse, not the generic kind. And so again, you see evidence for design or fine-tuning there. So it's not a single argument, but I do think there's a interesting and compelling way to put together a design argument, even in the context of a multiverse.
What's your response to that?
Okay, so I think we have to be a bit careful when we start talking about Boltzmann brains, because you'll hear a lot, the Boltzmann brain is a real problem for the multiverse. And hopefully people will watch our film, and Alan Guth and I discuss this issue. And a really important point is that a Boltzmann brain is a problem also for a single universe. Because if you have a universe that's expanding and it has a cosmological constant, it will expand forever. So eventually a Boltzmann brain will form. So the Boltzmann brain is not a problem that's specific to a multiverse. It doesn't allow you to disfavor a multiverse. In fact, the complication is, what Alan Guth says was that the multiverse can solve the Boltzmann brain problem because you have to wait a very long time for a Boltzmann brain to form. And in that time, enormous number of universes have been formed by inflation. So it's quite possible that normal observers will outnumber Boltzmann brains. And the multiverse then can solve the Boltzmann brain problem, which is quite hard to solve in a single universe. And moreover, how many Boltzmann brains are there and how many normal observers are there? Well, they're both infinite. In an infinite multiverse. Mm. So you have to come up with some way of regulating the infinity, of sort of ordering it. Everything happens in a multiverse that can happen, but not with equal probability. So you have to come up with some way of... There's a thing in mathematics called measure theory. So you have to come out with what's called a measure. And it's true that this measure problem in some sense is unsolved, in that no one's been able to come up with a definite measure, say this is the measure. But what cosmologists have been able to do is find measures where normal observers in the multiverse outnumber Boltzmann brains. And so you can use that as a way of picking a favorite measure, but it's not a definite way.
I think I'm following. It is a bit mind-boggling. I mean, one of the things that's also been raised, I've seen in some popular articles, is the whole question of, well, if we are part of a multiverse, another kind of counterintuitive idea is that wouldn't it be more likely that we are part of a computer simulation by some other advanced technology? Because if there is a multiverse out there, there will be an advanced technology out there producing amazing computer simulations, and they will themselves be able to produce all kinds of apparent sort of universes within themselves. And therefore, and then if that's true, doesn't that undercut the whole idea of us knowing anything about what's going on? Because then the science is whatever those aliens feed into their multi. And then the whole thing just breaks down because it's like, okay, well, we don't know anything then, really, do we? I mean, okay, what do you say to that kind of stuff?
Okay, I think there's two responses I can think of immediately. The first is, we don't actually know it is possible to simulate a universe with conscious beings in it. There's a lot of debate amongst computer scientists about, is there a limit to what computers can do? And maybe they actually can't do this. Mm. So that would be one get out. A second get out is, well, don't forget, in the multiverse, the number of real universes is infinite. So actually, you can't say the number of simulated universes will outnumber normal universes, because the number of real universes is infinite.
Yeah, I guess I see what you mean. But no, yeah, Jeff, do you want to come in on this?
No, I was just going to say your comment is interesting there, Phil, because I think this raises an interesting point of, is this even something we can answer scientifically? You know, so... You know, there's two aspects of that. One is, do Boltzmann brains and do simulations say that, you know, the multiverse is wrong, or that it's not scientific, or that it's not compatible with an atheistic worldview, or there's those sorts of questions. But I think your comment there about, well, you can choose ways where there's more than this than more than that, is that it makes it very difficult to say, how do scientifically do we answer that question?
Well, it's a difficult question. I don't want to deny that. The measure problem is a very difficult problem. However, if you think that we are not Boltzmann brains, this actually can help to solve the measure problem, because now what you can do is you can cut out a lot of the potential multiverses out there and say, well, look, if we can't be a Boltzmann brain, and there are reasons to think that we can't be Boltzmann brains, and if you buy those reasons, then you say, well, those measures cannot be right.
What are the reasons that people give for thinking we're not Boltzmann brains, outside of there's something that just doesn't resonate with me that we're a Boltzmann brain?
Well, one reason that I've heard is that you can't be a Boltzmann brain because you would predict that you are going to see the universe disappear in the next second. And every time you observe the next second and you don't see that, that's falsification of a Boltzmann brain hypothesis. Now, I'm not saying that's a convincing or not convincing argument, but that is an argument that has been advanced.
Okay, so those are the kinds of arguments people get. That's fair. So,
yeah. I mean, for you, Jeff, as a Christian, you're open to the multiverse, but do I get the sense you're saying that given that there are issues around the type of universe we might expect to see, and that it sounds like you're saying, yes, I would expect there to be more of a Boltzmann brain, unless there is a God involved in the process, and unless... Are you saying that there's still an element to which you think God has to be behind the process in order for us to be experiencing the kind of universe that we think we do experience?
Yeah, that's the way I would say it is, you know, when I first encountered the multiverse, I originally just thought of it kind of from an apologetic perspective, you know, can I just dismiss this so that I don't have to deal with it? But then I began to ask the question, okay, say we find evidence for a multiverse, does that fit within Christian thought or not? And, you know, I had to say, I looked through the scripture, I couldn't find evidence against it. I found evidence that God's created other things. And so I think, you know, okay, there's a consistency that maybe God did create a multiverse. That doesn't bother me. But then there's the question of how do you... If the multiverse exists and life is purely physical and everything happens that can happen, to me that raised philosophical problems of, you know, what does it mean to be Jeff Zwerink? What is justice? Is there any meaning? And, you know, the issue of Boltzmann brains and computer simulations. And from a Christian perspective, the fact that God creates humans here on earth, and apart from God's intervention, you're not going to get humans, that just is in Christian thought, that all those problems are solved very, very readily. And so I think it makes the best sense of all of that data.
I mean, in as much as the fact that we do find ourselves in the universe, we find ourselves, is more consistent with a kind of theistic worldview than an atheistic one. Is that the takeaway?
Yeah, that's the way I would characterize it. And I would say there's again two distinctions I would make. I think there's a lot of evidence for a Christian to look and say, hey, this matches what I would expect as a Christian the world to look like. Then there's another question of, does the multiverse and how does that all fit in? And does that in any way negate an atheistic worldview? And I think that would be an overstatement at this point. I mean, I as I've listened to Phil, I can I can see why he looks at that position and says, hey, I think atheism is the best view. I don't think there's any scientific evidence that argues against that, but as I evaluate it, I think theism is a better explanation.
Well, what about you, Phil? Do you think the multiverse has any bearing on either position, theism or atheism?
Well, I agree with Jeff that you can be a Christian and believe in the multiverse. I don't think it contradicts Christianity. But I do. What I would say is if you're a Christian because you buy into cosmological arguments, then the multiverse should worry you. But if you're a Christian for some other reason, then it shouldn't worry you.
Okay.
Why so?
Yeah. When you start talking about the multiverse, it throws up all kinds of crazy scenarios. As Jeff said there, you know, in theory, anything can happen. And in that level, you know, where if an atheist believes in the multiverse, is it not possible that they should also believe in miracles, let's say, because there's a universe where Jesus walked on water?
Right.
Okay, because anything can happen. Right. So that itself is sort of counterintuitive, because it will sort of then throw up all these kind of strange things of like, well, you know, maybe we do live in that universe where right. where a being that we call God sent his son Jesus to earth and he performed all kinds of miracles, you know. Right. What do you do as an atheist with those possibilities,
sure.
let's say?
Well, they don't worry me, and I'll tell you why. Because what happens in a multiverse is it doesn't say anything can happen.
Mm.
It's anything that can happen will happen. And not with equal probability. So here's in a case I was thinking of.
Mm.
So imagine, my wife loves crime shows. So imagine, you know, the prosecution comes back, the DNA matches, and the chances of a match is 1 in a billion. Okay, so imagine the defense said, yeah, but somewhere in the multiverse, that's going to happen. Right? So what should the prosecution, how should they respond?
Yes.
What they should say is, you're right, somewhere in the multiverse, that's going to happen, but it's incredibly unlikely it's going to happen here. Mm. There will still be a billion more times of universes where that doesn't happen. So actually, the multiverse is irrelevant to those questions. It's only relevant where you have a selection effect. So if you say, I have to live in this universe, like, you know, if there's some fine-tuned parameter that can only be some value, you have to live in that universe. You don't have to live in a universe where the DNA matched by chance. So in those cases where there's not a selection effect, and in fact, selection effects, you can use them to predict things. So Steven Weinberg, famously in 1987, he's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. Mm. You know, he's one of the most respected physicists in the world. He predicted, on the basis of multiverse theory, if you like, that there should be about 60 to 70% of the sort of energy budget of the universe should be dark energy. And in 1987, no one was saying that. In 1998, that was discovered. So I think there is this difference, if you see what I mean.
Jeff, do you have any further thoughts before we go to another break on the kind of anything that can happen will happen and how that affects atheism versus theism?
Well, I mean, I do think that the moment you say everything that can happen does happen, it does raise a problem for, are we actually discerning the truth, or are we just figuring out some explanation by some criteria that we like? I mean, it's fine if you want to say, well, probability, this is, or from a probability perspective, this is the most likely explanation. But very often, why the probabilities are used is to say, that's not a good explanation. That's not right. The most probable explanation is most likely, or is most likely to be the true explanation. And so, when everything can happen, how do you rule out those other ones except to say, oh, they're just kind of unlikely? It seems like there's a fundamental undermining of what I've always thought of science as trying to understand what is actually the truth of what happened, and that troubles me. So,
yeah. We're going to go to another quick break, and we'll come back and just have a little more conversation on some of these aspects of the fine tuning of the universe and the implications for Christianity. We may have another crack of the whip at some point as well to try and get into multiverse theory later on in the year. But you're listening to a program in which we're getting quite deep into the science, the philosophy, the theology of the multiverse. Who's Afraid of the Multiverse is the name of Jeff Zwierink's book, and he's with Reasons to Believe, examining multiverse theory and its implications for Christianity. Phil Harper, our atheist guest on the program today, is behind a number of YouTube documents documentaries tackling what he believes are often common misconceptions in Christian apologetics, and his latest tackles the multiverse. I'll make sure there are links, of course, to both my guests from today's show. Do check it out online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and we'll be back in a moment's time. Welcome back to the final part of today's show, and we'll be hearing the final part of the discussion between my guests Phil and Jeff on the multiverse in a moment's time. A quick reminder that if you enjoy this kind of stuff here on Unbelievable, you should visit the website, tell your friends about the podcast as well. Many people download it each week. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to Unbelievable the Conference on DVD. That took place in early July. Loads of brilliant speakers from around the world joined me in London with about 750 people, and we enjoyed a wonderful day looking at some of the central claims of Christianity and particularly how Christians can do evangelism more effectively in today's day and age. So I really encourage you to get hold of a copy. You might want to get hold of the DVD CD, or indeed you might want to get the digital download, particularly perhaps if you're abroad and you don't want to pay for the shipping costs. It's all available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find a link there, or go directly to the Premier shop. That's at premier.org.uk/shop, and click there. There's also still some Unbelievable t-shirts available that we were selling at the conference, so get those before they run out, featuring our super evangelist kind of logo on the front, so that's all available, as I say, from the Premier shop. Just a quick mention as well before we come back to our discussion and hear some feedback as well towards the end of today's show. I will be at the Rethinking Hell conference. It's the third international conference from Rethinking Hell. That's a group that supports the view that's sometimes known as annihilationism or conditional immortality as a view of what will happen to those who are not saved. And so they're going to be presenting that with some eminent people from here in the UK. Roger Forster, David Stone Brewer are speaking, as well as Welsh apologist John Tancock, or JT as he often goes by. Chris Date is the organiser from the US wing of Rethinking Hell. When and where? It's in London at Highgate International Church, Friday the 7th and Saturday the 8th of October. I'll be hosting the Saturday of that. The Friday is actually free to attend, so if you're not sure but you want to try it out, why not go on the Friday evening, and then if you like it you can book in for the Saturday. But do let them know if you want to come along. They want to get places booked in. RethinkingHellConference.com should be very interesting. That's really where the conversation is at the moment, isn't it, in the evangelical world on hell, the debate between eternal conscious torment and annihilationism, or conditional immortality as it's called. We'll be hearing from both JT, John Tancock, and Chris Date on next week's programme, just to give us a little flavour of what to expect if you are going to be going along to that conference. Right now, let's get into the final part of today's scientific discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we finish up today's show, we've been asking who's afraid of the multiverse. Phil Harper and Jeff Zwierink have joined me. Many Christians regard the multiverse, the idea that there are many universes, as an attempt to escape the force of the argument for design from the fine-tuning of the universe. If there are many universes, then we just happen to be in the one where the fundamental constants and quantities permitted the development of life. Many people, and I would count myself among them, have responded, well, there's no evidence for the multiverse. Well, my two guests today on the programme, both Christian and an atheist, are persuaded, in fact, that multiverse theory is probably true and predicted by our best theories about the universe. So we've been hearing today from Skydive Phil, as he goes online, Phil Harper, and if you want to check out his latest film on this whole issue, his YouTube channel is Skydive Phil, and Jeff Zwierink, who's our Christian guest, astrophysicist with Reasons to Believe, and he's the author of Who's Afraid of the Multiverse, reasons.org, for more about them. And it's been really fascinating having you both on. It's been challenging as well, as I should say, though, Jeff, because I think many people may have thought, okay, Justin's got the Christian on to defend fine-tuning and he's got the atheist on to knock it down. But actually, Jeff, your own thoughts on fine-tuning have obviously changed over the course of time. I mean, when it comes to the multiverse and the issue of fine-tuning, I mean, at some level, it sounds like you're not willing to let go of the idea that there is design involved at some level, that you can't simply jettison design because you've got a multiverse. There's still a sense in which you say that there has to be a kind of a guidingness to this process. Otherwise, there are too many kind of things that don't get answered. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, if God is the creator of the universe and he's revealed himself in the scripture, then the scriptures make it pretty clear that God has a purpose for creation. And so that's when we're looking for, when we see fine tuning and those sorts of things, Christians have said, ah, that's evidence of that design or there's purpose there. And so just simply because one argument for that purpose or design goes away, to me, doesn't say that it's going to disappear. And I find it intriguing that as scientists have looked at the universe and studied and understand what it takes for life to be here, they seem to repeatedly uncover that this universe looks like it's designed for life. That, to me, doesn't seem a scientifically controversial statement. And so even in the context of the multiverse, if it may remove one way of arguing for it, I would still expect to see some sort of design or teleology there. And so I'm just trying to look, how as a Christian could I articulate that accounts for the best scientific understanding and, I hope, responds to what the best arguments from the atheist position would offer. And so it's really just kind of trying to wrestle with that. And I think there are ways to do that. And, you know, I think in my discussions with Phil, I don't think he finds them as compelling as I do. But I think there's a way to do that. So,
I mean, one question that has occurred to me as you've been speaking there, Jeff, is I guess a very simple question of, and Phil, I'm sure, would be able to want to contribute to this as well, is why do we assume that these other universes that get produced have a great range of other possible types of constants and quantities and so on that would enable that kind of variation so that we would eventually come out of the mix at some point across the wide variety? I mean, is there part of the theory that does predict that there would be a wide range of different constants and fundamental qualities and so on of the fundamental forces predicted in this particular theory? I'll come to you, Jeff, and then to Phil.
I think that that's a very reasonable explanation, given string theory and how we envision our physical laws came, or you know, how we get the exact form of our physical laws. I think that's a reasonable assertion to make, but I think that's one of the places where the multiverse theory is untestable, and that we can never actually figure out whether the laws of physics are different or the fundamental values are different in these other universes. And so if you're going to explain the fine-tuning away, you've got to have that. But I don't know that that's a testable aspect of multiverse theories.
It to some extent, is that an assumption that's made about the theory, Phil?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to think about this. The first is, it's certainly true in string theory, you will get different constants. Now, of course, I'm not claiming we have evidence of string theory, okay? Not saying that. If string theory turns out to be wrong, then, okay, we don't know what these other universes look like. But let's suppose that they all have the same constants. Let's suppose they can't vary. To me, then it's very difficult to pose the fine-tuning problem, because the whole fine-tuning problem is they could have been different.
Right, sure.
But if you've got all these universes and all the same, then maybe, you know, there was a mathematician friend of mine said, you know what, if you do an experiment and you find something incredibly improbable the first time you do the experiment, the simplest explanation is you're wrong that it's improbable.
Okay. I can see where you're coming from on that. I mean, let me throw out another objection that sometimes gets leveled at the fine-tuning argument, Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest explanation is the best. You shouldn't multiply explanations if one will do. I mean, does that have any legs to it as far as you're concerned, Phil?
To me, I think, you know, John Lennox said, you know, something like it was the grandest violation of Occam's razor we'd ever see, something like that. And I think this is to completely misunderstand the concept of parsimony, which underlines Occam's razor. The thing is, it's the simplicity of assumptions that go into your theory, not the number of things your theory predicts exist. So let's suppose Jeff and I were betting, how many planets do you think are in Andromeda Galaxy? Now, we've no idea how many planets are in the Andromeda Galaxy, but it's a pretty safe bet that it's like the Milky Way Galaxy, highly. There's billions and billions of them. Now, if Jeff said, I think it's three, now, from the John Lennox perspective, that should be a simpler statement, you know, that's more parsimonious. I would say it's less parsimonious because you would need some special assumption to come up with three, whereas you don't need any special assumption to come up with billions.
Well, it would be interesting to get someone like John to interact on these issues and see what he makes of it. But do you want to add anything to that, Jeff, before we start to wind things up here?
Well, I guess the only thing I would add is that I think, I'm a little reticent to malign a pretty accomplished mathematician in the same way I'm pretty reticent to align many of the cosmologists who have different perspectives than I do. But I would say this, that the Occam's razor kind of cuts both ways. To some, a God who exists, who creates everything, is the simplest explanation. To others, that you have the entire ensemble is the simplest explanation. And so it's not clear to me. There isn't just this cut and dry way of applying Occam's razor there. And so I think it could be used for either side of this argument.
Okay. Really interesting. Thank you both for being with me on the program today. Again, if you want to find out more, I've put the links with today's show. If you want to go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, links there to Jeff's work and also to Skydive Phil's YouTube channel. And Phil, thank you for being with me on the program today.
Thanks, guys.
For Justin coming in. Jeff, I don't know. Is there anywhere to go after the multiverse? Do you feel like, to some extent, maybe we always say these too soon, but have we reached the limits of what we can explore if we're talking about universes which will never be open or accessible to us in any verifiable sort of sense? We're having to go on what we think the science shows us, and barring some kind of science fiction wormhole where we can travel to these different universes, are we reaching, I guess, the limits of what we can know scientifically almost?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I guess my perspective is, let the scientists go in and sort it out and play around and figure it out. They've done a pretty good job over the last few hundred years of figuring out what we can answer and what we can't answer. And it may be that answer or something that we can't answer now, in the future, we'll figure out how to answer it. And so just kind of let the scientists keep playing around and figuring out. And if you have a stake in the game, study science and start being part of the conversation.
As Phil has. Thank you for coming in. And thank you, Jeff, for being on the line as well. Great to have you both with me on the program today.
Thanks very much.
All the very best.
Thanks for the invitation, Justin.
You're very welcome. And thank you for listening. Again, if you want to get in touch, I'll give out the ways to get to do that in just a moment's time. This is Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. It's been a really good dialogue, good chat today on the issue of the multiverse. I wonder what you make of it. Perhaps you've got some issues that weren't raised in the show today, some objections to multiverse theory that you think we should debate on the show. Very open to doing another edition of Unbelievable, looking at these issues and, of course, the fine-tuning argument. So do send your suggestions in as well. But for the moment, thanks for listening today. Thanks for being in, Phil and Jeff. And we'll hear some of your feedback in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'd really love to hear from you about today's show. Obviously, both my guests today, Phil and Jeff, saying that they think on balance the multiverse is a good hypothesis. Not necessarily that they definitely think there is one, but certainly giving the case for the multiverse. Perhaps you'd like to hear the case against the multiverse as well. If you've got some suggestions for people who'd be good to do that, I always welcome them here on Unbelievable. Perhaps you'd like to feedback your own particular thoughts on that as well. I don't think the fine-tuning argument is by any means done and dusted, I'm sure we'll revisit this topic before too long and perhaps hear other points of view on it as well. But in that sense, I don't want to ever duck any sort of new information, new learning that comes to light, which may be a challenge to some particular arguments for the Christian faith in apologetics that have been put forward. And we like to think we're at the cutting edge of having those conversations here on Unbelievable. Again, if you want to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, you can also get in touch via the Facebook, the Twitter and everything else at UnbelievableJB on the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to get in touch that way. Lots of people have been emailing, and I've been saving up the emails over the summer period in order to be able to bring you them in one fell swoop over a few weeks. So what we're going to do today is, because I've had a lot back up, we're going to go back right back to Gary Habermas and Michael Roos and the couple of shows they were involved in. Also that discussion with Beth Grove and Jay Smith of Fanda Apologetics on their ministry to Muslims. And maybe we'll get some time to look at some of the emails that came in on the back of the debate on basic beliefs. And is God a basic belief between Tyler McNab and Stephen Law? And perhaps next week we'll get to some of the responses. And many there have been to the Derren Brown shows and indeed last week's live programme, The Unbelievable Live in California. Firstly, though, just a quick thank you to Paul, who gets in touch to say that he had been listening to some of my other radio engagements while I was in the United States over the summer. It was a real privilege to be able to, while I was in New York with my family, actually go to the Eric Metaxas radio show. Eric Metaxas, well known as an evangelical author, but most recently has developed his own radio show, daily radio show, broadcasting from New York. And so I was able to appear on that and tell him about Unbelievable and reach the audience that he reaches across the US, across a large Christian radio network. And I was able to interview him myself as well, actually. So if you're a reader of Premier Christianity magazine, and there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be, then you'll be able to read my interview with him in the forthcoming October edition, in which he spells out his reasons for why he has actually endorsed Donald Trump. I mean, I say endorsed. He's really anti-Hillary, is what I'd say. And so Trump is anything but Hillary, as it were, I think is the mantra. But you can read that in the forthcoming edition of Premier Christianity magazine. I was also able to appear on the Stand to Reason podcast as well with Greg Kokel. Anyway, Paul gets in touch to say, I wanted to say you've proved yourself over the years of doing Unbelievable to be an excellent interviewer. But over the past couple of weeks, you've proved yourself to be an excellent interviewee. I listened to you on the Eric Metaxas and Greg Kokel shows. You were so interesting and engaging. Well done. Returning to your interviewing skills, you mentioned in your interview with Derren Brown the monumental work of N.T. Wright, The Resurrection of the Son of God. I just finished it last week, and if Derren read it, he would never say again that Paul knew nothing of a physical resurrection. Wright shows there was no other kind. Everyone, whether Jew or Gentile, knew that resurrection was physical. And you go on to the Michael Ruse, Gary Habermas debates. Also, if Michael Ruse read it, he wouldn't say, as he did when on with Gary Habermas, it doesn't matter if Jesus rose bodily from the dead. It's hard to understand how such a good thinker couldn't see the massive ramifications of Jesus' resurrection, given the claims he made about himself. Great to hear you, whether interviewing or being interviewed. Thank you very much, Paul. Really appreciate that lovely note of encouragement. This also came in from Kath, and I thought it worth reading out. It says, thank you for your podcast. It was extremely helpful when I was trying to decide whether Christianity is true. And having come to the conclusion that it is, I'm now particularly enjoying the intra-Christian discussions about different beliefs, practices, and traditions. In an old episode with Peter D. Williams, one of my favourite guests, along with David Robertson and Nabil Qureshi, you expressed a wish to make an episode on Mariology. Did you do it? And if not, is it still a possibility? As well as Mariology, I'd love to hear discussions about what the sacraments mean, theories of salvation and justification, different understandings of communion and Eucharist, and what is the church, visible or invisible, and is there a mystical body of Christ? Thanks for your unique and fascinating programme. I'm listening to old episodes as well as new ones, but still have hundreds to enjoy. Thank you, Kath. I'm glad to hear that Unbelievable played a part in your own conversion. From the type of subject you're obviously interested in hearing discussions on, I'm sort of assuming you are a Catholic. That's what you've converted into. But no, we never did do that Mariology discussion, and it would be interesting to do that. Perhaps there would be a significant sort of feast day or something to tie it in with that we could do it at some point. But thanks for the suggestion. And just a quick one here from Luke, who says he's set to debate David McAfee later this month in Seattle Town Hall on September the 24th on the question, Christianity or atheism, which is more reasonable? David McAfee, apparently a rather well-known young atheist. He's written four books, has almost 160,000 followers on Facebook. In contrast, Luke says, I'm a part-time seminary student at the tail end of my MDiv and also working full-time to support a young family. Your programme's been a real encouragement to me and has increased my interest in apologetics over the years. So I contacted David about 6 months ago and he's agreed to fly up from California to debate me. I'm the first Christian he's debating. Additionally, my church and the Seattle Atheists are sponsoring the event. And my church even offered to support me financially while I've been preparing. So that's been great. So anyway, you want to say if there's any chance of mentioning this debate on the show, could I do so? Well, there you go. It has been mentioned, Christianity or atheism. And that's between David McAfee and Luke van der Weeg. I'm assuming that's how I pronounce your surname. Going on there at Seattle Town Hall on September the 24th. You want more information? There's an event page on Facebook. You can also look it up at seattleatheists.org. Thank you for sending in the email. As I say, loads of emails here and never enough time to get through them, is there? But going back to the Habermas and Gary Habermas and Michael Roos shows, where they debated the coherency of naturalism and then debated miracles. Darren says, how many emails did you get pointing out the irony of having a podcast questioning the coherence of naturalism while at the same time using all the technology produced by that same naturalist assumptions to produce and deliver said podcast? I don't know. I think you're making a false dichotomy there between what might be called methodological naturalism, which is the process by which we do science in order to find out the way things work, and what you might also call a metaphysical naturalism, which is the assumption that all that exists is matter in motion and so on there, Darren. But thank you for getting in touch. Here's A. Hendrickson in Bergen, Norway, says, science explains, as far as I understand, how things work. Something that can drive me nuts in discussions like this is why people aren't challenged on why the universe exists at all. The question of the universe being eternal, does that really give meaning? I mean, something physical, something which changes, is that really possible? Sam wanted to say what a delight it was to listen to Michael and Gary. These two are among the most gracious guests to regularly come on the show. I greatly enjoy their banter, as well as their ability to consider one another's points. Sometimes in discussion, it seems like the guests are listening with the intent to find a weakness in their argument to pounce on. With these two, it seems that both guests really just listen to one another and consider the viewpoints being expressed. On both sides of the divide, we could stand to learn from the open-minded way of debate and discussing, though I'd suggest we lean more towards Gary's brevity. My dream episode would be having Peter Atkins on one end, James White or William Lane Craig on the other, and Michael Roos somewhere in the middle trying to cause confusion for everyone. Anyway, I enjoyed the last 2 weeks' shows. Very happy whenever either of those guests come on. Graham from Whitstable Skeptics says, on the subject of miracles that came up in that, and of course it came up again with Darren Brown later, but says, I'm always frustrated by those who affirm the existence of miracles, but they don't give at least one contemporary example backed up by the evidence which would make any other explanation highly implausible or impossible. I ask this in the context of there being thousands of devout Christian doctors who could supply this information and would be motivated to do so. Obviously, I'm not expecting to see evidence for an amputee growing back a limb, as Christians for some reason rule that type of thing out. But it is strange that many miracle claims concern physical changes to the body, so I can't see why not. Clearly, it will be hard to convince hard-nosed atheists like me, but even I would find it hard to deny the evidence, particularly if it was cumulative. I recall an American you once had on claiming miracles happen all the time and said he had a fax from a doctor, but now it had faded and it was no longer available. Perhaps we could ask for an email. We will revisit this subject of the miraculous and the sort of documentary evidential side of it, because I feel it's something that we need to return to, especially in light of that that Darren Brown interview as well. Just one more here on Gary and Michael. This was from JD Walters. Says, it was a good exchange, but two important issues were discussed far more simplistically than they should have been. Gary rightly pressed Michael on the implications of the success of science, but couldn't explain why Michael can't help himself to that success as evidence for naturalism. The problem with appealing to the success of science is that both theism and naturalism predict a world governed by natural laws and mechanisms. According to classical theism, the fact that nature exhibits law-like behaviour is evidence of God's steady providence in maintaining an orderly creation, a world in which the existence and activity of human beings is possible. The occasional miracle does nothing to invalidate that. If both worldviews predict that we should observe an orderly nature and successful science, the success of science cannot count as evidence for one view over the other. Michael also distorted the historical evidence by resorting to the usual atheist canard that in the past we explained plagues, thunder, etc. as divine punishment, but now we know they're biological. But the claim was never that plagues in general were always the result of divine punishment, but rather that this plague or that illness was a punishment, leaving plenty of room for most plagues or illnesses to happen as a result of natural causes. You also go on to say, Gary presented values, free will and persons as evidence against naturalism. I don't see, however, that this is where the conflict really lies, to borrow a phrase from Plantinga. As Michael Roos pointed out, there's a difference between naturalism and physicalism. There are physicalist and non-physicalist varieties of naturalism. To take just one example, the near-death experience researcher David Russo embraces what he calls naturalistic dualism, under which human beings do have a separable soul, but that soul is just as much a part of nature as the body. Soul and body are just two different kinds of natural things. I'm not even sure why on a theistic worldview one would want to insist that objective values are somehow alien to the rest of nature? Would we want to say that a human soul somehow possesses an otherwise lifeless mechanical body? You finish by saying the real conflict point between naturalism and theism is whether there is a good case that nature is self-existent and self-explanatory, or whether it has a derived existence and persists as a result of the action of a divine being. So the locus of the discussion should have been the theistic arguments, not particular properties or persons. All right, thank you very much. I've only had time really to get through some of the emails regarding the naturalism episode. Let's try and fit in one or two, though, in response to what followed after that. That was just Jay Smith and Beth Grove joining me to talk about their ministry to Muslims, particularly Jay's some 20 plus years of doing debates, high level octane debates as well. Lots of interesting response to that. It caused some controversy. People who didn't like the fact it was obviously just two Christians talking to me about that on that particular edition of the show. Those who felt there was a sort of some kind of Islamophobia on the part of Jay and Beth was something that they obviously denied on the programme, though I think people struggle when Jay Smith says it is absolutely my intention to destroy Islam. Now, I don't think he's in any sense saying in any violent way. He's saying ideologically, through argument and so on. In any case, that caused some controversy, but lots of people who also really enjoyed hearing that show. Perry Marshall got in touch to say, what a barn burner of a show. The Islam episode was riveting, fascinating for both the cultural aspects and his observation of the changing landscape over time. Then the piece at the end about modern scholarship applied to Islam was a home run with all the bases loaded. Certainly something I want to come back to again in the future. We'll get to some more of your feedback on that programme next week, because we've run out of time. So it's never enough time, is there? But we'll make more time for feedback next week. And loads of great shows in the offing, including we're going to be getting Tom Wright back in studio. He's got a new book out this October on atonement, and he's going to be doing a discussion on that with me here on Unbelievable. And we're also going to see if we can do a bit of a Q&A with Tom as well. So if you've got questions you'd like to put to NT Wright, Tom Wright, why not email them in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do that before the 2nd of October, and we'll be able to include those in that discussion that we're going to be having with NT Wright. Right now, I'll finish by telling you what's happening on the show next week. You're unbelievable. Something a bit different. We're going to be looking at the life of an important but often underappreciated theologian and philosopher, Soren Kierkegaard. A new book is out on his life by Stephen Backhouse. He'll be joined by Jane Williams. They're both contributors to The God Pod. It's a very popular theological podcast. They're both part of St. Miletus, a theological training college here in London. Should be a really interesting conversation. Do join us again for that. The Profile is here next on Premier Christian Radio.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear FIGS. Because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts, and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your FIGS? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room, listening to this podcast? Wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.